I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. As lifelong Disney fans, the work of countless talented Disney creatives have shaped our lives.
Now, as the Disney catalog expands, we're taking a journey through film and television to discover if that spark that shaped us as children lives on in adulthood.
Does your favorite Disney media still cast that same spell? Join us as we find out. We are
Rewatching the Magic. Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday.
Oh, this is going to be a very special episode. We are breaking our format, and we are talking about a movie that was rejected by Disney. Nimona, which has been a really big success on Netflix since they picked up the film. But yeah, this was originally going to be a movie from Blue Sky Studios. That's 20th Century Fox. 20th Century Fox's old animation studio. When Disney purchased 20th Century Fox, the big merger, one of the big casualties of that merger was the closing of Blue Sky Studios and the canceling of Nimona, which at the time was about 75% done. Which Disney as a whole, when a production is that far ahead, usually will let it go anyway. See things like the Marvel shows for Hulu, Hellstrom, Hitmonkey, and MODOK. Those shows were already in far enough in development that canceling them would have cost more than just to let them be completed. But for some reason, a 75% completed animated movie was completely shelved.
I wonder what that reason could be.
We'll get into that. Enter Annapurna Pictures, which had picked up the movie, finished the animation, and released it through Netflix. And yeah, the movie has become this big hit. And it's like, we have yet to cover Blue Sky Studios on the podcast for no reason. It just never came up. We just had a bunch of other movies we wanted to do before we got to like the Ice Age movies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Not to say that Blue Sky is a bad studio. It's just when you have like Marvel movies and Star Wars movies, Ice Age and Horton Hears a Who and Rio kind of slipped down the list.
Yeah. I'm gonna want to pause right here. And now that we've given you a little backstory of why we're covering a non-Disney movie on the podcast, I want to tell everyone that we're going to give you a little spoiler for the end of the episode right now. We are going to highly recommend that everyone watch this movie. That is why we're breaking format, as you may have guessed. So if you have not yet seen Nimona and you are listening to this podcast, please stop the podcast here. Go watch Nimona. And then you can come back to us. We'll be here. We promise.
We are prepared to get the entire movie spoiled for you. So if you haven't seen the movie, do so. Go do it right now. If you have seen the movie, stick around and enjoy our conversation.
Yeah, but you do not want this movie spoiled for you. Trust me. I think both of us went in not really knowing much, if anything, about this movie. And I think both of us were pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. So
we're going to recommend that you do the same thing. If you don't really know anything about this movie, go in as fresh as possible. It is great for the entire family. Like, I'd recommend ages 10 and up would probably enjoy this most, but there's nothing a younger kid would be upset about. There's no real like gore or violence or language, but I think like 10 and up is probably the target audience.
If your kid can handle The Owl House, your kid can handle this movie.
Yeah, and The Owl House is kind of why we're covering this, and we'll get into that later. So stop it here, go watch it.
All right, so let's go into a little history of Nimona, the webcomic. So Nimona the webcomic was created by N.D. Stevenson, who might be known today as the showrunner for the Netflix She-Ra and the Princesses of Power series. Way back in 2011, on Tumblr of all things, N.D. Stevenson posted this doodle of a black armored individual with a metal arm and this little sidekick in pink with the following description. I'm going to read it verbatim. Some character designs with some atypical color choices, I guess. I don't know what's going on in that area. This is Nimona and her supervillain friend. He doesn't have a name yet. I'm working on that. Nimona is his sidekick slash squire. They're like Batman and Robin of slightly medieval villains. She is actually way more evil than him. He does what he does to make a point, and he doesn't really want anyone to get hurt. Nimona just gets a kick out of destroying stuff. I'm going to attempt to make a two-page comic with them. We'll see how this goes. And that ended up becoming a very popular long-running webcomic that eventually gets turned into a graphic novel. The rights to the novel is picked up by 20th Century Fox and handed to Blue Sky Studios to produce an animated movie. And then you know the rest, because Disney purchases 20th Century Fox, closes down Blue Sky Studios, cancels Nimona.
Yeah, now we're going to talk about why we really wanted to talk about this and why we really wanted to talk about it now and how it connects to the Owl House. Because if you heard our episode on the Owl House, you will remember that someone who was never named by the creator of the Owl House, but who everybody kind of figures is Bob Chapek, canceled the Owl House because it was a bit out of step with what he considered the Disney brand, meaning that it had too many LGBTQ themes. And spoiler alert, like I said, you should have stopped the podcast right now if you hadn't seen it, but of course you've seen Nimona by now. We're trusting that you've seen Nimona by now. Nimona, lots of LGBTQ themes. I mean, Nimona is created by N.D. Stevenson. He is
a transgender,
you know, non-binary, uses he, him pronouns, transmasculine person. So, like, we are talking about a member of the LGBT community, just like with Owl House, that has created a story that speaks to the LGBTQ community. And, you know, discusses these themes. And then someone at Disney, who has remained nameless, but probably Bob Chapek, says, this is not our brand, and cancels it.
And this story, I mean, Stevenson did not transition until he was already working on She-Ra, which was years after this was already made. So you can kind of say that this was the start of his journey towards being transitioning. And there's a lot of trans allegories with Nimona herself, themselves.
Well, Nimona is constantly referred to with she, her pronouns. So I think it's safe to do that. However, in the movie, she does, every time that someone asks, what are you? She just says, I'm Nimona. She refuses to label herself.
She specifically says, I'm not a girl. But she also says,
she does.
I'm not people. She also says, I'm not people.
Well, yeah, and she does say, I'm not people, but there is that moment in the movie where she shifts into a little boy form when Bal sees her in that form. He said, I thought you were a little girl. And she said, well, I usually am. Today I'm a boy. Something like that. Mm-hmm. Which is a really, you know, good kind of shrug of like a very gender fluid seeming character. Even in her typically feminine coded form for most of the movie, it's not an overly feminine form. There is kind of an androgyny to her.
Shaved head, slightly pudgy, not necessarily, you know, there's no... Other than the fact that she is voiced by a female actor, there really isn't any other defining characteristics of Nimona being female.
Well, yeah, I mean, she's voiced by Chloe Grace Moretz.
Who, hit girl!
Yeah, it's hit girl. But I read what Indy said about as he was creating the character, and he said that Nimona's original design came from his background in being interested in cosplay. And prior to him coming out as trans, he always liked to cosplay more masculine characters. So even when he was still presenting more feminine, when he would do cosplay, he would do masculine cosplay. And when he created Nimona, even though she is referred to, even in the comic, with she, her pronouns for, you know, pretty much all of it, the design is very androgynous because I think his idea was he didn't want anything that was, for lack of a better word, very TNA. Like, it's not that typical, like, cinched-in waist, exaggerated bust, you know.
Armor that only covers the boob and butt.
Yeah, it's a character that a lot of different body types and people across the gender spectrum might feel comfortable cosplaying. And I think that's a very interesting character design. Because you don't find that a lot.
Of course. And keep in mind, this is her choice. She's choosing to look like this.
Yeah, this is her primary presentation. And I think it is important to note that. Because as a shapeshifter, she can look like literally anything. So this sort of femme-coded but slightly androgynous presentation that we see through most of the film, and of course in the graphic novel, is her choice of how she mostly wants to present herself. Which I find fascinating. I do like the various presentations that we see of her throughout. Her most frequent animal forms.
The rhinoceros, the gorilla.
The whale.
The whale.
You know. But also that she has the little demon child, which is possibly my favorite.
Demon baby!
Yeah, the scene where she shows up and just absolutely wrecks that dude without like even really touching him, but just like being creepy demon baby, is possibly my favorite sequence in the movie. Where the dude is just running from Nimona, and Nimona is just following in that, like, you know, with like keeps deepening the voice as the demon baby. That is such a great sequence.
The one they ended up using for one of the posters is her with the bat wings on her back.
Oh, yeah, I love those wings.
Yeah.
And of course, there's the tail, too, with the, you know, the demonic wings with the little pointed tail. So sometimes when she has the wings, she has the tail as well. But I like when she does the wings, it's when she's feeling most mischievous. Like she's really in her villain mode, you know?
Her teeth sharpen, yeah.
She's quickly become, like, very early in the movie when I was watching. And, of course, I went into this completely blind. The reason I watched this movie is because our good friends over at the Kyle and Luke Talk About Toons show were like, hey, watch this movie. And that's all I saw. Like, they just posted, like, you have to watch this movie. And I was like, well, that's good enough for me.
For me, I've been keeping tabs on this movie because ever since it was announced that Netflix had picked it up, for me, it's like, okay, when is this movie coming out? It was 75% done. Again, I'm not belittling the animation process, but what did they have to completely reconstruct this movie from scratch? Were they able to salvage anything when Disney shut the studio down? Those are questions I don't know. But the fact that they were able to reconstruct the movie and release this, I've kept tabs on it, been watching some of the trailers. Once that first trailer hit, I was like, yes, I'm watching this movie. I need to know what Disney threw away. I consider this the final Blue Sky Studios film, me personally. And in doing that, this is the best Blue Sky movie that they have ever produced. Sure as hell a lot better than Spies in Disguise.
Yeah. The thing is that I had not heard of this film when it was with, you know, Fox, Blue Sky, Disney. The first I heard of it was, like I said, when Kyle and Luke were like, hey, watch this thing on Netflix. And I went, well, I need a movie to watch tonight. And that's a pretty good recommendation. So I went in not knowing anything about this. Someone I respect said, watch this movie, it's good. And I went, good enough for me. So I turned it on and I loved it. Okay. I had no idea what it was going to be about. I had no idea who did it. I didn't know the background of this movie until afterwards when I looked it up. So I went into this completely no context. So, you know, we had slightly different things here. And honestly, while I am familiar with some of Indy Stevenson's work, I have not watched She-Ra yet. It does come highly recommended and it's on my list. I just haven't had time to get around to it.
I think I've only seen like the first two episodes and then I kind of dropped off. But I've heard it's really good.
Yeah, I mean, I want to see it. It's on my list, but my list is so long. And new stuff keeps coming out.
Yeah.
Like Nimona.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed how they started off the movie very quickly with, like, this movie will have gay themes. Deal with it.
Yeah, so we've got our main character, Ballister, who a commoner who gets trained to be a knight, 1,000 years in the future of the medieval era. It's medieval era mashed together with futuristic, and it's a really cool, unique world.
Ballister. Yeah, I just want to pause for a second and just talk about how much I liked the combination of the world, because it's very much medieval cyberpunk.
Yeah, what if...
Which I liked.
What if the medieval era had technology thousands of years before we actually got it? So you get cars that move on their own, but they're horse-drawn chariots. We got swords and crossbows and the knights are cops.
It's not that the knights are cops. It's that cops never evolved. Because frankly, that's sort of what knights and soldiers were before we had cops. That is very medieval period. You know, you wouldn't call a cop. There would be a soldier come to, you know, look into things.
You know? Instead of a cop pulling out their pistol to shoot, it's a knight pulling out this crossbow and shooting arrows.
Except the arrows are also laser beams. You know, it's like kind of a very fascinating mashup. You know, there are Goodyear blimps with you know, a big TV screens on the side of it showing the news, you know, sports coverage of the night trials as people go through the challenges to become new knights and everything, and
TV, cell phones, computers.
Yeah, they have their own version of the internet and everything. But the medieval aesthetic and the monarchy has continued.
Yeah.
It's a very fascinating mashup, which I like. But it is an authoritarian system, and it does seem to be a class divide system, because Bal is listed as a commoner, and they are not usually allowed to be knights. And it does seem that the public is divided on whether or not they like the fact that Bal is going to be made a knight, because he is not part of the nobility. We don't get a lot of background in the movie on who gets to be nobility and not, and where the nobility comes from. And
that is one of my complaints about the movie. The characters, the story, fine. But I want to know more about this world.
Yeah, we do see, you know, the backstory. You know, at the end of the movie, we get the snippets of backstory. And we see that Glorith, who is their, you know, big heroine that everybody kind of worships or whatever, that started the knights, she was just a little peasant girl, so she wasn't born to the nobility. And also we see that what she did wasn't exactly a vanquishing, in the sense of she was a great fighter. She just decided to uphold the status quo and go along with her village.
Mm-hmm.
And also she was like 8. So
very susceptible to what her parents were telling her.
Yeah.
That's not your friend. That's a monster. Monsters are bad. You're bad. Go back to where you came from.
Yeah, which is a bit, you know, when you're talking about the moral of the story, which I do think is a good one. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. But we get kind of a vague snippet of, okay, we were friends as kids, she betrayed me and built this entire society on the lie that, like, I'm a monster and she's keeping the world safe from me, you know? But we don't really get a lot of context for what things were like before that. And I would have liked to have known a little bit about this, because I'm just going to say right now, I've not read the graphic novel, but I have read kind of a synopsis of it. And the comic is very different.
And well, with the comic, Stevenson has openly stated that he had no idea where he was going with the story. He was just making it up as he went along. But knowing that, it's easier to translate that, cut out the, quote, filler, and then leave the meat and potatoes and make that into the movie.
Yeah, but also, he didn't write the script for the movie. I'm not even sure that this character of Glorith is even in the comic. I think that's a thing that's in the movie only. Because I never came across that in any of the stuff I read in the synopses that I read. So that might be a movie only thing. I'm not sure. But I think that they added it so it would be like a more personal thing. I think in the comic, if I have it right, if what I read was correct, that Nimona was like living in a village and she had claimed that she was like the child of one of the villagers, and the villagers claimed that, or the villagers got scared of her and said that they thought that she was in fact a changeling that was impersonating a dead child and had taken its place. And they captured her and sent her to, like, basically a mad scientist who did experiments on her and, like, awful things. And that's why she, like, really hated the society. So it wasn't like she was betrayed by a friend. It was like she was trying to find community, I think. And instead of, like, you know, accepting her and loving her, they were like, no, you're different. We're going to send you away to do the horrible experiments on you because you're different. The thing is that I wonder if, like, the legend of Glorith was something she perpetuated herself because she was ambitious and she wanted to climb through the ranks, or if, like, her parents were like, look what our child has done. What a brave child we have. And she was just too young to stand up for, you know, the truth before it got out of hand. Because we never know that part of the story in the movie. And I would have liked to have known that part of the story.
Yeah. It kind of makes me want more, but I'm okay with what we get. But let's get back to... does everybody want to talk about Bal here?
Oh, yeah, yeah, Bal. Sorry.
It's fine.
This is such a good movie, and it's got so many good parts. It's hard to, like, keep on one track.
So I want to talk about Ballister Boldheart, the commoner who gets accepted enrolling to become a knight. He is the commoner, as you said, half the city half the kingdom is against it because he is not of noble blood. The other half is interested. He's energetic. He's a go-getter. He wants to defend the kingdom. He has that heart. Obviously, the queen sees something in him and allows him to enroll. Fast forward to the quote modern day, where it is the knighting ceremony. Enter Ambrosius Goldenloin, the descendant of Glorith, and Ballister's boyfriend.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that when you first see Ambrosius, he's all like, I'm the best, and Ballister sucks, ha ha ha. And then you see them, you know, alone, and is like, hey, what's up? I love you so much. You're my boyfriend. You know, they're
holding hands, snuggling up with each other. They have a kiss at the end of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is that the movie does not play it subtle. Even though they don't kiss until the end of the movie, you know, it's very obvious that these two are, you know, boyfriends.
This is not the Disney gay. This is not a character that we can cut out for the international markets or dub over with a different lines in different countries. There is no cutting around this.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to cut out, like, chunks of exposition to cut out the fact that these two are a couple.
Why are you doing this? Because I love you.
It's very clear in the movie, like, these two are boyfriends. They are not roommates. They are not just bros being dudes. Like, they're like Captain America, these two dudes are.
Yep, they can do it all day.
Yeah. Well, he ain't called Golden Loin for nothing.
Hey!
I just love that Ambrosius is voiced by Eugene Liang, who is one of the Try Guys. So, shout out to him. And of course, we got Riz Ahmed as Ballister. This movie is straight up fire for its cast, by the way. Like, everybody in this movie is just super awesome. RuPaul is in here. And Francis Conroy is in here. And, like, Beck Bennett shows up for a bit. And, like, I mean, even Indy Stevenson has a cameo as the voice of the Quispy Dragon. pretty awesome cast. But love it. The thing about it, though, is you kind of wonder, like, what it is that's making Ambrosius do the PR thing of, like, Ballister sucks. I'm awesome.
He's signing autographs. He's taking pictures with kids. You know, he's like, look, here comes the woo. Woo!
Yeah, which is, I can understand, like, having the persona for fans or whatever, but, like, why is he crapping on Bal?
It's mostly Todd that's crapping on Bal. Toddius Sureblade, who was seemingly Bal's bully throughout training and still kind of looks down on him. Yeah, man, you know how I said that you weren't good enough to be one of us? You're still not. I'm still a dick.
Yeah, but the thing is that while Todd is the hype man, Ambrosius is also playing into that and not fighting it.
Also playing up that he is the descendant of Glorith.
Yeah, I mean, he's very much a nepo baby. The thing about that dynamic is I keep wanting to go, like, Bal, you deserve better. Like, I gotta say, I'm not a fan of Ambrosius. I mean, he eventually kind of does the right thing at the end. But he really only does the right thing when, like, the villain, wonderfully played by Frances Conroy, the director, she's called. But, which, I mean, can we just say, like, most obvious villain ever?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not really like, you
there's
know,
no twist
a
villain
twist. Yeah, it's like, but I'm not saying it has to be. It's kind of a movie aimed at, you know, preteens. But the thing is, though, is that, like, Ambrosius does the good thing eventually, but he only really does the good thing once it's so obviously the good thing that to not do it is to just be straight up evil.
Yeah, there are points where he's clearly, you know, if I do one thing, I betray Bal, but if I do the other thing, I betray my kingdom. What do? So he's trying to do both? Because he freezes every time he confronts Bal. He can't shoot him. But at the same time, he's calling him a criminal, a murderer.
Yeah, it's like, I won't outright kill you, but I'm also not going to help you. I mean, I wonder if his golden loins are getting, you know, a little rough from all that fence sitting he's doing. You know, it's like, pick a side, my dude.
Even when it looks like he is going to pick a side.
Oh, the nacho scene?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that scene was so brutal. Because it's like, okay, he's finally seen the light. And then he's like, you know, Bal's like, yes, you're right. We have to bring down the director. And Ambrosius is like, no, not the director. We have to bring down Nimona. She's a monster. And you're like, oh, dude, you were so close.
Yeah.
So close. You were almost there. I was almost with you.
Nimona's been manipulating you this entire time. She's a monster. She's trying to turn you into a monster.
Oh, that was so brutal. Like, I absolutely felt daggers in my heart during that scene. I was like, oh. That's, I don't know if you've ever spoken to a gay Republican, but that is exactly what it's like.
Ooh.
Like, don't at me. I said what I said.
I mean, this movie's filled with social commentary, so why not?
Yeah, no, I mean, but that's exactly what it's like, where it's like, how can you be saying the thing you're saying that you are so obviously on the wrong side here?
Yeah. And you kind of feel sorry for Bal, because all he wanted to do was serve his kingdom. And he goes through all of these trials and tribulations to do so. And when the moment comes, when the queen is handing him his sword, you are officially Sir Balthasar Boldheart. The assassination happens. He gets set up to kill the queen because the director is so against a commoner becoming a knight that it would so disrupt the society that they had that the only logical conclusion was to kill the queen.
And that, I think, is probably the thing that's got to hurt Bal the most, because they set up that he met the queen when he was a little kid, and she saw something in him. She saw promise in him, that even though it was against the rules, against the society, she said, okay, I know you're a commoner, but you're just as good as the rest of these noble knights. Okay? So she picked him for this path. And he finds out later that the director, the second in command or whatever, the woman who trained him, the woman he thought of as, you know, I mean, that's his Obi-Wan, you know?
Yeah.
And probably a surrogate mother, because you have a feeling he's probably like an orphan or something. Mm-hmm. But again, the movie doesn't go into it, but you have a feeling this was his family. Like, he's been with them since he was a kid. So he thought the world of this woman, and then in her confession, she says that she killed the queen. She set it up so that the queen would die by his hand, because him being knighted was the first crack in the dam, the crack in the wall, that would let the monsters in. That he was a monster, basically. Just because of how he was born. I mean, again, not very subtle social commentary here, but, you know, that idea of, we've allowed you to be part of our society, you know, we've opened the door just a little bit, and that's going to be the downfall of everything. You know, so we had to murder the person who let you in. The person who was nice to you, you know?
And frame you for her murder.
And frame you for her murder, you know, which is just the icing on the crap cake there, but like, to discover that all of this was set in motion because somebody was nice to him had to be just the worst blow of it.
Not just someone, the ruler of the kingdom, the highest authority in the land, was nice to him, so the highest authority in the kingdom must die. For being nice to a commoner, a poor person.
Yeah, it's just brutal, but also very pointed commentary. Mm. Which I love. I mean, it's the reason why I love this movie. It's very graspable in the way it talks about society and bigotry and the lengths to which people will go. Look around us and you'll find many people like the director. And it's sad, but true.
We cannot let those people succeed, because if those people succeed, it could mean the end of our society.
Yeah. And we say just like a week after the Supreme Court struck down, you know, the affirmative action stuff. Yeah. So, you know. Huh.
And then Ballister gets literally disarmed.
By his own boyfriend.
Yeah. Which he forgives him for.
He's because like, you know, that's the way we were trained. Oh.
Like I said, he didn't cut off my arm. He was disarming an attacker.
Yeah.
And I do love how both Nimona and Ambrosius kind of agree. Cutting off someone's hand is not a love language.
Yeah, I love that that's a repeated line. Cutting off your arm is not a love language.
But kudos to Ballister for being able to create a prosthetic robot arm, presumably with his less dominant hand.
But also in a cave with a box of scraps. So Tony Stark would be proud.
Yeah.
The thing is that I like that Nimona has apparently just been, like, tooling around for 1,000 years waiting for somebody to sidekick to. Are you telling me that this is the first potential supervillain this place has seen in 1,000 years?
I think it's because he was called a monster. Because you don't see her face change till they say, he's a monster. And then she says, he's perfect.
Yeah.
Because finally, I found someone like me, an outcast.
But also, this is a kingdom that is so xenophobic that they've built a wall around it.
I wonder who paid for that wall.
The outside world. Which there apparently is an outside world, because we do see them once the wall comes down, you know, once there's a break in it, it does appear that they've set up trade with whatever's out there. Because we do see, like, you know, caravans and stuff going back and forth at the end of the movie. It's kind of subtle, but you know, you get the feeling that there's now, like, tourism and trade and stuff going on.
Yeah.
So I do wonder, like, what the rest of this world was thinking about this place.
Who knows?
Like, is this place like the weird little North Korea of this, you know, world they're on?
Who knows?
Again, like, everybody's like, well, don't go to the kingdom. They've still got monarchy and medieval aesthetics.
And the people are forced to be, you know, like, are taught to be afraid of the outside world. Don't go past the wall. It's death.
Like, do you wonder if the rest of the outside world are watching the broadcasts of, like, oh, it's knighting ceremony again? You know?
Yeah.
There's, like, some version of the UN out there that's like, what do we do about the kingdom? You know?
Yeah. Who knows? But I must say, the prison break, that whole prison break scene, where we see Nimona quickly change forms and the whale that busts through the floor, that whole thing is beautifully animated.
Yeah, the whale that just keeps falling through floor after floor after floor. Although, I was very surprised at the, like, joke about it being cold in there. I was not expecting that joke in a movie for that age group.
Yeah, they bust into the men's room, and then you see, I think it is Todd, and they see him, and he's like, it's cold.
Yeah, it's like there's like the shrinkage. Shower room that, you know, yeah, Nimona there's... busts through and, like, makes a joke about it. But the thing is, though, is that I like the foreshadowing of Nimona showing
her resume.
Well, the plan before it happens, where he's like, I'm fighting with a rhinoceros and I'm fighting with, like, an otter and, like, you know, and then later in the movie, you see her change into all those animals. And then it's only after they get back to the lair and Bal sees the drawings again. And he's like, oh, this was you telling me you could shapeshift, you know? Which I liked. I also love all the random, like, meme jokes and stuff that are in there. Like, that they use the Banana Splits song.
If I had a nickel for every time a Chloe Grace Moretz movie featured the Banana Splits theme song during a fight scene, I'd have 2 nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice.
Yeah, and then the fact that at one point they do a shout out to Pizza Rat.
Yeah.
Which I was not expecting.
I do like, after that, we get kind of the fake the fake out origin story, how she goes, I was just a girl and I made a wish on a wishing well that I was on a subway with a loser asking stupid questions.
Yeah.
Which some people have misinterpreted as that's her genuine origin story. Like, no, she was making it up because he was asking stupid questions.
Yeah, in the comic, she also gives a fake story. And we also never seem to know where she came from.
I think that's best. Like, she's not, this is not a curse. This is not a magic spell. This is just who she is.
Yeah, she's just a being that is natural to this world. She's not an aberration of humanity. She's just another living being.
But we do see that some of that story is true, as we do see she is just a shapeshifter trying to find her place in the world. She tries hanging out with various animals, and they can sense that she is not one of them, so they ditch her. And then she ends up meeting Glorith by the well, and then we kind of talk to the rest of it. They become friends. There's a huge misunderstanding. Glorith picks up the sword, go back to where you came from. Legend is born. And it's a very heartbreaking scene because that is literally, for 1,000 years, that is all Nimona wanted, was just a genuine friend. And when she reveals herself, everyone gets scared. So she's never really had a true long-lasting friend. Until Belle.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, and maybe it's just me, but, like, I would absolutely love to have a friend that could turn into all kinds of random stuff.
And I do like, you know, they get closer, and then Belle starts taking on Nimona's speech patterns and catchphrases. Hey, metal.
Yeah. The thing is that there was something about just the way she approached everything that I just loved so much in her characterization, that she immediately was like, hey, what's up? Come on, who are we going to kill? And he was like, we're not going to kill anybody. Come on, we're going to kill him a little, right?
You know, it's pretty much what Endy Stevenson says. She's really into being a villain. She's chaos incarnate, and Belle is only a villain by circumstance.
Well, in the comic, I think Belle was more villainous. And then I think that the idea of the movie is that Belle is not at all a villain, and Nimona is only villainous because she's been hurt. She never wanted to be a villain, but it was more like, all right, you know, you want me to be a bad guy, I'll be a bad guy, you know?
Because she sees the world as it is versus the fantasy that everyone else sees it as. Even it takes Belle most of the movie to figure it out. You know, like, there is no redeeming this system. This system is corrupt through the core. Even when they have the evidence that proves Belle's innocence. From the Squire. He gets the cell phone from the Squire of the video of the director switching the swords. Nimona is telling him, we need to upload this video so everyone can see it and you can prove your innocence. His thing is, no, I'm going to talk to the director, I'm going to talk to Ambrosius, and we're going to settle this that way. Which, anyone could see it from a mile away, was never going to work.
Yeah, because the director just smashes the phone.
Belle is so still ingrained into the system. He, as Nimona says, he is literally brainwashed that the system is the only way it's going to work. And then comes the realization right after that, that no, doing things by the book is not going to get your name cleared, because the system is designed to go against you.
I think the most important thing in the movie, especially for the younger audience, maybe, or I don't know, maybe for the older audience. I think the younger audience is probably learning this just by default these days. But, you know, it shows very clearly that it's like, all right, the system can change, or I can just start destroying everything. The director's just like, all right, let's just, you know, blow everything up. Yeah, I'm just gonna kill a bunch of my own people, but you know, at least the system will prevail, you know, after the carnage.
I love that line from Ambrosius. Maybe we were wrong. Maybe we were always wrong. And rather than admit that maybe you're wrong about something, this person is going to destroy everything to prove themselves right. Rather than admit that maybe you're wrong, which is something that we see all the time in the real world.
Well, the double thing
down, is, triple down, yeah.
Yeah, the thing is that, I mean, once again, look at some of the things that are going on right now. There are people who will purposefully destroy things and then look at a marginalized group and go like, look at what they did. And it's like, no, they didn't do anything. You broke stuff. And they're like, no, they did it. You know,
so I had to do it because they would have done something bad with it.
Yeah, and that's what the director is doing. It's like she takes the cannons and she turns them inside. You know, they're meant to be pointed outside the wall in case there's an external threat. And she turns them inside and they're like, if you fire the cannons, you're going to kill a bunch of our own people. And she's like, eh, collateral damage. There's a monster here somewhere. You know? Like, not even knowing what she's aiming at. She's just going to start firing indiscriminately because maybe there's a monster. You know? Mm. And, of course, Nimona can look like anyone, which is the point, you know?
I do like that when she does shapeshift, she keeps that pink color. It reminds me of the wizard battle from Sword in the Stone.
Yeah. The thing is, it's you know, I like that because, you know, it does help keep track for the audience, you know, especially for the little kids. But I do like the one time, I think the only time that it doesn't happen is when she shapeshifts into humans.
Yeah, she doesn't have the pink when she's the kid. She shapeshifts into Bal and Ambrosius, and they both are perfect copies.
Yeah, but when she shapeshifts into animals, or, you know, when she does things like add wings to herself or whatever, they're always that pink color. Hmm. But when she does an impersonation, it shows that she can be perfect, you know, in that impersonation, or almost perfect, you know. She doesn't have the person's mannerisms quite down.
She's still, you know, chaos incarnate.
Well, because, like, we see in that thing with the director when she gets the confession, you do get the understanding, if you're paying attention, of course, that it's not Ambrosius. Hmm. Because she doesn't quite act like him if you know him well, you know?
And the overacting on the death.
Well, and the overacting on the death. But the thing is that I also think, and I'm having trouble remembering, I think that in the flashback when she's doing the other animals and flitting around, I don't think there's that pink there.
There is. It's still there. And I think that's why the other animals don't see her as one of them, because she looks different or maybe smells different. I don't know.
I didn't think it was there until after she was betrayed by Glorith in the thing, because I think that when she also shapeshifted into her little girl form at the start, it was just like a brown-headed little girl, and there wasn't any pink. So I think that that pink was a rebellion. Like, she wasn't trying to fit in anymore, either with the humans or the animals. Because if I remember correctly, and I may be misremembering, but I think in that flashback when she was trying to fit in with the various animals, I think she was trying to copy them exactly. And they still felt something was off, except for Glorith, who just kind of accepted it at face value. Like, oh, you are another little girl. And the reason why I think she stayed around Glorith is that when she forgot herself for a second and changed into a bird to go get the apple or whatever, and bring it down to Glorith, Glorith didn't freak out. Glorith was just like, oh, this is my friend who can do things. And when Glorith didn't freak out that she could shapeshift, because there's that moment where Nimona was like, oh crap, I shapeshifted in front of a human, it's going to run away from me. And then Glorith didn't. She was just like, oh, cool, you can turn into a bird. Neat. And then there's that whole montage of, like, her being a horse, and her being a gorilla, and her being a, you know. And Glorith is totally chill with it until the village, you know, the adults freak out about it. And they're like, no, 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 that's not right. That's a monster. You can't play with that thing. Because I love what that shows, because honestly, if you, more often than not, I'm not saying that there's not bigotry among children, because they do learn it very quickly. And children can pick out the weird one in the group a lot of times. But more often than not, it is learned bigotry. Or it is, if you have a group of children and there's a bunch of them that are one way and then one child stands out in some way, there tends to form like an in-group and an outsider. But one-on-one, children that I've observed when I've worked with children, they tend to get along kind of okay. You know, and they don't really seem to have too much problem. It's just like, oh, here's another child, let me play with it, you know? And so I think that that's what we see going on, is that they get along well, they play fine, and the differences between them are just like, okay, this is just another way we can play. This is just, I have no context for this being weird, because I'm a child. That's just who and what you are. You know? And then the adults show up and they immediately put their prejudice into Glorith. And they're like, no, Glorith, that's wrong and bad and awful. You have to be scared of that. You have to denounce that. And you do feel bad for Glorith, because she's a child. She is a literal child. We do not know how old Nimona is at that point. Because by the time we meet Nimona, she's like over 1,000 years old. Because the flashback is like 1,000 years in the past. So we know that she doesn't age in the way that humans do.
If at all.
If at all. So we don't know how old she was when she met Glorious. But Glorious looks to be like 8, 10 years old. It's a very young child. And so she does not have context for what's going on here. I mean, think of everyone you've ever met suddenly going like, this one person is evil. And you're 8. I don't think any of us, I know I wouldn't have been able to. Mm-hmm. And I don't really think any of us would have.
And I do like, you know, after this is the big reveal and they have, you know, Ambrosius shows Belle the scroll that shows that Nimona is Glorious monster, the monster that was defeated 1,000 years ago. And his whole demeanor changes, that he falls back into the system. You're a monster. You're evil. You've been manipulating me. I'm going to take you in and I'll be a knight again, or, you know, stuff like that. The ultimate betrayal for Nimona, and like that starts her down. I mean, the words that she says to Bao earlier, everyone wants to stab a sword through my heart, and some days I wish I would let them.
Yeah, that line, I mean, my goodness, when she said that line, I was like, oh my goodness.
Like, if everyone wants to kill me, some days I wish they would, just to end it. How many people go through that every day?
Yeah, I mean, it is heartbreaking. And the fact that I know so many people who are going through this now, you know? But it is, you know, and if that's you, hang in there, because there are those of us fighting for you, and we love you. But it is truly heartbreaking when she says that, because you hear her say that, and you know she is literally the monster under the bed for this entire kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when parents tuck their kids in at night, it's like, be good or the monster's gonna get you. And she's literally that monster. There's a giant statue in the center of town to honor the worst moment of her life.
Yep.
And it's just like, oh, you feel so much for her.
And the betrayal and anger when Bao betrays her, and she says, say it. Say the word. I want to hear it from you. Call me a monster.
And of course, I mean, the symbolism when she goes back into what might be her native form, you know, the giant black kaiju.
All of the dark feelings in her, and you hear every negative word throughout the entire movie. Why can't you be normal? You're a monster. Are you even human? You don't belong here. Go back to the gutter. Go back to the darkness from which you came. It just gets too much, and she just lets it all out. And it's a beautifully animated scene. All that, the entire screen goes black, and she becomes this black kaiju monster, rampaging through the kingdom just to end her life.
Yeah, and the shot of her in that form standing in front of the statue of Glorith and ripping her own chest open, getting ready to impale herself on that sword, is one of the most effective images I've seen in animation in a very long time.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, every frame of that, you're just like, oh, I feel every bit of that. Because it's like, you know, maybe you should have taken that little wooden sword and tried to run me through all those years ago, you know?
I'm going to finish the job you started, Gloris.
Yeah.
And I love the sound design because it's clearly an animal noise that they've mixed into Chloe's screaming.
Yeah, I mean, the sound design and the music in this are just amazing. Because, of course, it's Christoph Beck doing the music, and just what a genius. But, yeah, I mean, the sound design on this is amazing because they've got all the animal noises and stuff as she shifts through various forms. Mm-hmm. And they mix them all into the final kaiju form at the end there.
Mm-hmm. And then the last person to betray her, the true friend, Bao, just holds her back, literally putting his hand on her heart and saying, I'm sorry, you didn't deserve this.
And admitting he was wrong, which is what Ambrosius said, like, maybe we were wrong.
Did Nimona deserve all of that hate? No, all she wanted was a friend. But no, everyone saw her as a monster. And even when that shows up, even when that is shown to her, the director just can't stop. She's gone too far. She has to destroy the monster because of her delusion of, if I let the monster live, there goes our society.
Yeah, and the thing is that Nimona does the one thing that she can, is like, well, I'm gonna prove I'm not the monster. You know, earlier in the film, where we see Nimona saving a child who gets caught up in the crossfire as her and Bao are escaping the castle, and there's a little girl, and she's about to get hit by, like, you know, some arrows or something, you know, and Nimona shapeshifts and saves the kid. And then, because the kid is scared, Nimona shapeshifts into a little girl and is like, hey, I'm not going to hurt you. Are you okay? And everything. But because the little girl just saw Nimona shapeshift, the little girl screams, monster, monster, and runs away to go find her mom or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you notice that, like, Ambrosius takes note of, like, well, wait, you know, why would the monster save a little girl, or, you know, whatever. But it doesn't really hit him to question that until later in the movie. But we do see that Nimona isn't quite as villainous as she keeps claiming through the first part of the movie. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that's the same form that she took with Glorith originally.
I think, like, it
when
is,
you,
yeah.
When you see later in the flashback. But we finally see at the end of the movie a larger version of that, because Nimona realizes that, like, well, the director is turning the cannons inward in order to get to her and Bao, and it's going to injure a lot of the civilians. And so Nimona does the only thing that she can think to do, which is to use her shapeshifting ability, and she becomes a phoenix and she blocks the shot, but seemingly dies.
The director also dies too.
Well, yeah, I mean, the director dies because Nimona kind of, you know, encases the cannon and, you know,
takes the full blast.
Confines the blast to that one area, so it destroys the cannon, the director, the part of the wall, and seemingly Nimona. But we see her actually caring for others, you know, and the innocent bystanders. She has no problem beating up the knights because they're on the wrong side. You know, they're out to hurt her. But we never see her actually trying to hurt anyone who's not actively aggressive toward her. Which I like.
She's not completely evil. She's just evil against the system or something.
Yeah, I mean, she only ever targets people who are part of the system and currently actively upholding the system. Even when she talks about being a villain with Bal early in the film, it's very much, it's never just, hey, let's go out in the streets and cause mayhem. It's, let's specifically go to the knights and take them out. Let's target, you know, this one guy looks punchable because he's a knight, you know, like.
Actually, he is quite punchable, but that's not the point.
Yeah. But she's never just like, let's go up to a random noodle stand and start some stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, that's not her MO. Even when they do things like steal the car or whatever, they keep the woman who's trying to sell the car safe. Mm-hmm. Because she's not done anything to them. She's just a bystander. And even once they realize that the guy with the very punchable face, who's kind of a bully, isn't actually their enemy per se, they just let him go. So I like that even though it's supposed to be a movie about a girl who wants to be a villain, she's got a very clear code of morality. Which the actual villain of the story does not have.
Nope. It's doesn't matter what's going to happen. We need to keep our system in place no matter the cost, even if I kill half the kingdom.
And also, are people pure? There is a very clear delineation. There is noble, there is commoner. There is monster, there is human. There is inside the wall, there is outside the wall. You know, there are these divisions, and things must not mix. Sound familiar? You know, I mean, yeah. It's not terribly subtle sometimes, but things don't always have to be subtle and super metaphorical, you know? Mm. And I like the way it sets up these things sometimes. I wish we knew more about the world and how it evolved, because I love the setting. And honestly, I kind of wish we could have gotten something more. This almost feels like too much story for a movie.
Yeah, maybe if this was, I mean, it is based off a web comic, so there's a lot of story there. But it feels like maybe this should have been a TV show or something.
Or a mini series.
Yeah.
Like, I could have done, like, you know, this is like a 4-episode mini series or something. Like, I'm not even saying a continuing series. It would have been really nice if there had been something more to set up the world, because it's such an interesting concept and I would have liked to have known more and explore the backstory. And I only say that because I love it so very much that I want more of it.
honestly, you could cosplay as Nimona, just with purple hair instead of pink.
Yeah, I mean, I do kind of already have her hairstyle. And her outfit is pretty good. The thing is that I love her vibe. I love the way that they do all of the things. I love their lair. Her little villain lair that she has.
Evil Larry!
Yeah. The way that she kind of bounces around gleefully, you know, trying to figure out ways to do evil, even though her heart is kind of really pure, you know? It's like
Chaos incarnate, and I love her for that.
Yeah. I am one who loves my chaotic characters, as you know.
Yeah.
So this kind of fits right in with the sort of thing that I love. And I think that she and Belle make such a great double act, you know? I love them, you know, their version of Monopoly or whatever it is they're playing in that one scene. That's great.
I rise up. I start, and then I rush the castle. Yeah, you still owe me 600 gold.
Yeah, and then her being like, money is fake, you know, like, which is kind of me playing Monopoly, which I never do. I'm honestly more like Matt Mercer playing Monopoly. If you've ever seen him play Monopoly on Game Grumps, when he tried to be like, can we privatize the utilities? That is absolutely me playing Monopoly. It's like, I don't like capitalism. Can we privatize all of the things? I don't like being a landlord. Can we set up free housing? Mm-hmm. But the way that they have all these characters interact, if I had a quibble, it's only that there's not really enough of a redemption for Ambrosius for me to really feel like, yeah, that's the guy you should be with at the end of the movie.
Part of me feels like, what if Ambrosius was more of a villainous character than what they had? And maybe in the comics he is, I don't know, but I feel like Ambrosius would have been a better villain character than the director.
Well, I think it's important that he's not a villain character. He's just he's just the douche who goes along with everything. Mm-hmm. He was born to privilege. He's a Nepo baby. He doesn't see anything wrong with the system because it's always worked for him. And honestly, like, yeah, he's hot and he's got Eugene Yang's voice, which is also hot. But, like, honestly, dude, I think you can do better.
But one more thing I will say before we wrap up is I love this art direction in general. Because, yes, this is a CG animated movie, but that they went through the effort of giving this a cel-shaded look. So it kind of looks half hand. It has that hand-drawn look, but with that 3D motion. And I kind of like that. But they don't go for the photorealistic or anything like that. It's just, it looks more cartoony, and I like it. That looks cartoony.
Oh, yeah. Having seen the original drawings that Indy did, and then see how they've been turned into the animated form, I like the way that they've been translated onto the screen. I like the character design, so bravo to everybody who worked on character design. Also, I love the background designs, all the world building, all the prop designs. You know, everybody who did design work on this, you are incredible, and I am in awe of you. Because this is one of the best designed movies I have seen in a while. I like the way the original drawings have been rendered here. I like the way that it looks hand-drawn, even though it's CG, like you said. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the big one that a lot of people did point out, and it makes my heart warm, there is an entire section of the end credits dedicated to everyone who worked at Blue Sky Studios.
Oh, yeah.
It's Blue Sky Studios. It's Nimona S. Scrat from the Ice Age movies. And it's everyone who's worked at, who was employed by Blue Sky Studios at the time of its closure. That to me, that's enough to make this a Blue Sky movie. I will credit me personally. I don't know about anyone else, but me personally, going on saying these are all the people who helped make this movie happen, and of the studio that no longer exists. Also, it's in one of the backgrounds of one of the shots of the movie. There is a billboard that says "Blue Sky Never Dies."
Oh, I missed that. I'll have to go back and look for that.
So yeah, there's a lot of shout outs to Blue Sky Studios in this movie, just as them saying, you know, hey, even though the studio no longer exists, Blue Sky never dies.
So I think that, you know, I mean, it's not a Disney movie, so we're not going to ask the question. Mm-hmm. But I think the question to ask here is, how badly did Disney screw this one up?
Very. This is, as I said, me personally, this is the best looking and best written movie to ever come out of Blue Sky Studios. I understand why Disney did not Disney shut this movie down. Stupid reason, but.
And I mean, let's not say Disney, because I'm still saying Chapek. I would bet so much money, Chapek. I mean, are you with me on that? Do you have a different theory?
I'll go with you on that. I'm willing to entertain that theory. There's no other theory that makes sense, but I'll go with it. So, you know, Chapek shut this movie down, whoever, was a mistake. But I also see that at this time, Disney had a lot of movies that they had no idea where it would go. That's why so many of the Fox movies went to Hulu. A lot of people said, oh, why didn't it, like Prey and all those movies, why didn't this movie get a theatrical release? Literally, Disney did not have the space, did not have the schedule, the space in their schedule to put these out in theaters, because they would, as we're seeing now, that a lot of those Disney movies are overlapping each other and taking viewers from other movies, like we saw with last year with, you know, Black Panther and Strange World and other, and, you know, a Marvel movie and a Pixar movie, a Marvel movie and a Disney movie, something like that, just kind of overlapping and one taking away viewers of the other. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but it makes sense to me. I understand all of that. That being said, Disney throwing this movie away, Chapek throwing this movie away, whoever, the fact that they looked at this movie and said, no, this is not what we want, probably the biggest mistake of the Fox merger. Because they gave this movie to Netflix. And if this movie does not win Best Animated Feature, there is no justice.
I'm just going to say, I don't know what's going to come out in the next
6 months.
But from what has come out recently, I'm with you.
It's this and like, Spider-Verse. I'm going to be honest. It's this and Spider-Verse.
And yeah, I haven't been able to see Spider-Verse because, you know, of the reasons we've discussed. So I haven't been able to see it yet. But from what I've heard, that's the only competition that I would put this up against right now. I wouldn't be mad if it was Spider-Verse.
Sorry, Ruby Gilman. Oh, I'm so sorry, Elemental. you're really good, but you're not as good as Nimona.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is that this could have, if they'd have kept going with production on this when they acquired it, which was back in 2021, this could have really helped Disney Plus during that dip it had. Mm-hmm. And they were desperately trying to find stuff to put out on Disney Plus. Come on, you know, like, this could have been a big win for Disney, and instead they just handed it to the competition. And it's a big win for them. And all I can think of is that bit in Pretty Woman where Julia Roberts just walks in with all the bags and is like, you work on commission? Big mistake. Huge. Mm-hmm. Like, you just handed it to a different store. What were you doing? But that's kind of, I'm gonna say that's kind of where Netflix sort of has it over Disney Plus as far as the streaming service right now, because Netflix keeps putting out all these like really good LGBT themed shows. Disney keeps going like, we had a character say a line.
I mean, Netflix is no innocent. They have shut down their own animation division before, which also put this movie in jeopardy.
Yeah, and I'm not saying, like, Netflix is, like, super queer positive or anything. They keep giving Dave Chappelle comedy specials. But the thing is that as far as producing things that have queer themes in them, they are doing far better right now than Disney Plus is as far as streaming services. Mm-hmm. You know, we just came out of Pride Month, and we talked about before about what was in the Pride section on Disney Plus. I'll tell you, the Pride section on Netflix, so much broader.
The fact that this came out on the last day of Pride Month, going out with a bang.
Yeah, and that was the other thing, is they dropped it, like, literally the last day of Pride Month, and a bunch of people either had been waiting for it or heard it very quickly by word of mouth, and it immediately shot to, like, you know, number one on the service, because it was like, the entire gay community was just like, hey, there's a new thing, go watch, you know.
It ended up being the most watched original animated film in Netflix's history. It is still in the top 10 most watched films. And we are recording this about a week after the movie, 2 weeks after the movie came out.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. But you know what? Knowing the way the Academy works, since they tend to vote for whatever movie their kids watch, it's going to be Mario.
Maybe. I'm going to say that there is that quote that certain people like to say, which is, you know, go woke, go broke. And for all my sins, I actually know the guy that came up with that. Or at least I used to. The thing is, though, is that that phrase has been around long enough now that we actually have economic data on that. And that is bunk. The numbers do not hold up with that. It is exactly the opposite. People actually show up for more diverse stuff. People want to watch things where they are represented. Marginalized communities also have money, believe it or not.
I mean, for all its faults, for Disney still sells Pride merch because they know it'll sell. They may not want full-on gay characters in their movies, but they'll take that gay people money.
Yeah, my co-host says this knowing how much I have dropped this year alone on Disney Rainbow Murder. That was a very unsubtle dig at me right there, my man. And love I will you. Take it. I will take it because I am exactly that person. I am exactly that person that owns the Rainbow Mickey glasses and the Rainbow Mickey pins and a full, because you know this now because you've seen the pictures, a full set of Rainbow Disney character plushies.
Gotta get the ears for the full merch look.
Yeah, I don't have any like actual rainbow ears, although I do have a lot of rainbow ear pins because you know me, I'm a Disney pin collector. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do need the, although I do have my Loki ears now.
Oh yeah, cool.
Yeah, I was able to get the official Loki ears now, so everybody can relax. I have been hunting for them for years, and they were always sold out, but I finally snagged a pair of the official Loki ears. I have them. We can all rest easily now. Thank you, and good night. No, but yeah, no, I do need the official Pride ears, but the, yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, I will ding rainbow capitalism as much as anybody else, but you know, capitalism sucks, but if we're going to have capitalism, I'd rather have rainbow capitalism than not.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather have corporations realize, like, hey, we'll be inclusive than cut us out as a community. Mm. Because, you know, wouldn't you rather have a corporation be like, hey, the Latinos have money too. We want you to feel comfortable at our business.
I mean, we're about to get a Latino superhero on Blue Beetle very soon, so they obviously know that Latino people have money.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, you'd rather that than be like, nah, Latino people aren't interested in things.
Yeah.
You know, they don't watch movies or TV shows or go to Disney parks, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you'd like some Puerto Rican flag ears, I'm sure. You know, like...
I just bought... Now, you know, I've mentioned on this show, I am a wrestling fan. I bought my first WWE shirt in years because it was a Puerto Rican flag shirt of the Latino world order. So yes, you get my, you could take my money, capitalism, for merch like that.
Yeah, I mean, there is something to be said about, like, okay, yeah, I don't like being pandered to, but I'll take a little bit of pandering. It's better than being left out.
Yeah.
And honestly, at the end of the day, that's kind of what representation is about. It's not about being pandered. It's just remembering that we exist. It's the thing. It's the old Simpsons joke about finding your name on a keychain at the, you know, the souvenir gift shop. And like your first name is not traditionally spelled. You know, so I'm mm-hmm. sure you've had that issue mm-hmm. of like, you can't find your name on the keychain at the gift shop. And it's like, wouldn't you be happy if you just found your name spelled the way you spell it at the gift shop? You'd be like, yeah, that's, it's just, I am also represented here. And it's like, okay, yeah, cool. That's what I want. It's not that you're pandering to me. It's just that you remember I exist. Hmm. And I think that that's all diversity is about, is it's just, you remember that I exist. Thank you. You know, and it works behind the scenes. Like there is a, you know, a trans masculine person who got his comic made into a movie. That's awesome. Those people exist and they're creative and they make cool art. Please give us more of that perspective. You know?
Yeah.
So good for Netflix for picking this up, and boo on Disney for dropping the ball on this one, because this would have been such a cool thing to be in the Disney catalog. But you screwed up, Disney.
Yeah, screwed up majorly. And like I said, it's possible that they could have, that because of their blunder, they might give an Oscar to Netflix.
That would be so cool.
That would be the ultimate middle finger
to Chapek.
Yeah.
This is our kind of F Chapek show. This and the Owl House show. I can't believe that you would look at a property like this and go like, yeah, but there's guys and they're more than dudes being bros. Oh my goodness, this is such a cool story and such a cool idea and such a good thing. And Blue Sky was apparently knocking it out of the park.
I want more, but yeah. I also am okay with this being a one-off.
Yeah, I mean, if it has to be a one-off, this is a great one-off. I wish we could have gotten like a miniseries. I think It's perfect for a miniseries. I'm not sure this is a multiple season idea.
Mm.
I think a miniseries would have been perfect, you know.
Six or eight episodes telling this story.
Yeah. But I don't know. I just, things like this really double down on, like, what does a CEO even do other than screw over creative people sometimes, you know?
It's what happens when you have numbers people involved in movie studios rather than movie people.
Yeah. Shame.
Shame. So, but enough about David Zaslav.
Yeah. Screw Zaslav, but yeah.
I think that's all we can say about this one. So let's move on to next week. Back to format, and a movie that I personally have been wanting to talk about for a while, a movie that I grew up with, the original Adventures in Babysitting. Nobody F's with the babysitter, and we're going to find out why next week.
Yeah.
So come back for that, and we will talk to you all next time. Metal.
Oh, I want to do some villainy.
Don't let the magic stop here.
Join our conversation online on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic,
Twitter at Rewatch the Magic,
and of course, new episodes every week at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com.
Remember, the magic is for everyone.
It only stops if you let it. Podcasts are fun,
but there's work to be done.
We encourage you to get involved. Here are some organizations we support.
The American Civil Liberties Union fights for the constitutional rights of all Americans. Find them at ACLU.org.
The National Network of Abortion Funds helps people find access to safe abortion services. Their site is abortionfunds.org.
The Trevor Project provides a 24/7 crisis helpline for LGBTQ youth and education services for schools on LGBTQ issues. They can be found at thetrevorproject.org.
Or find a way to help in your area. Is that good, or do you want to do a third round?
I think we can do that, and you can piece it together from the two.
All right, that sounds good. Let's stop the recording.